You are listening to 89.5 KPOO San Francisco, and welcome to Reality Sandwich, where every Thursday at noon we serve up a palatable taste of the truth on topics of the mind, body, spirit, community, all six areas of the healthful living model, and you can read more about that at healthfulliving.org. My name is Martin Matthews. I'm a certified clinical and medical hypnotherapist and healthful living advocate with Healthful Living, and I'm here today with my partner,
Julie Matthews, and I am a certified nutrition consultant with Healthful Living.
Today on Reality Sandwich, we are going to be connecting with a Reality Sandwich name mate from New York City. Daniel Pinchbeck operates the website realitysandwich.com. And you can tell right off the bat that our listeners are going to go, this guy has got to be in alignment with us in some regard. He is an author, a writer. He has written for the New York Times, Rolling Stone magazine, and now he has his second book out back in 2006. His first book, which came back, I'm not sure how many years ago, but his first book was called Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey into the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism, where he explored shamanism and the use of psychedelic substances to expand reality and put forth his sort of understanding and learning that that view of reality had some validity in what our world is playing out today. And that's continued on to a second book, which we are speaking about today because we're absolutely fascinated, Julie and I, with this whole nature of reality, where we are in time, and what's going on with the year 2012, and what does that mean in our world? What does it mean in this time? What are we experiencing? What are we going through at this amazing point in transition? And 2012, the return of Quetzalcoatl, is Daniel's journey of looking into all of this phenomenon in the world in his own life. So I'm just going to get him on the line because... Julie, did you have a quick comment?
Well, I wanted to talk about how we first found out about this book, which is sort of an interesting experience in and of itself, which mirrors to the fact that we both have shows called Reality Sandwich. I first saw this book when I went into the Scarlet Sage, a little herb shop down in the Mission in San Francisco, and I just ran in for a second to drop something off, and I saw this book out somehow is glowing in the corner or something, and I looked at it, I read the back, I looked inside, I went out to the car to tell you you had to go in and look at this book,
right,
even though
we
were parked
right.
on like, you know, in a bus zone.
Double parked in the
and
Mission.
We didn't end up buying the book at the time for whatever reason, and then like 2 months later, another random person that you had met told you about him and his book.
Right. Because at the time, we had been doing some more of our own exploration into 2012, the Mayan calendar and this expansion of consciousness and what the Mayans had spoken about. You had read Callahan's book. You and I had gone to the Yucatan about 3 years ago just now. And we were just kind of looking at how all that is coming forth, what that's meaning in our lives, why we started Healthful Living, what's going on with our work. And then we saw this book and just connected with Daniel on his website. And then fortuitously, through a friend, a new friend, Matthew Sluter, said, hey, I know Daniel. I'll give him a call or send him an email. And we've got him on the line now, and I'm just absolutely delighted to connect with Daniel Pinchbeck.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. Thanks for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, Daniel, you seem to be a real introspective, curious lover of life and explorer of the human condition. And I'd like to talk a bit about just your take on your role in what's unfolding right now in this collective journey that we're all experiencing in life. But what are you seeing that you're bringing forth, both certainly through your first book, but now what you're channeling, what you're studying, what you're writing about, that you're bringing forth in 2012, this return to Quetzalcoatl?
What is my role? It's an interesting question. I mean, you know, I've always been a writer, sort of done my whole adult life, and I always would get really passionately curious about different areas and want to use journalism to, you know, share my enthusiasm with other people. And, I mean, that's basically, like, I sort of still feel that is basically my role. Like, I definitely get very curious and try to, you know, learn what I can and then do my best to kind of share it. You know, and I think part of my role is to sort of keep questioning. You know, I don't really, like, I think sometimes when people have gotten into these areas, they sort of become very definitive at a certain point, or they sort of pose themselves as authorities or gurus, And I actually feel the space that I'm trying to hold is one that's more open and you know, not as determined. And in a way, I think it's a sort of methodology that I'm developing, which is then now, you know, part of the website and you know, our magazine, Reality Sandwich, so other people are kind of picking up on. So how do we really, like, openly interrogate, you know, all of the different structures and belief systems and ideas that that our kind of reality is made up of, so maybe we can find a better, you know, some better ways to proceed in the future.
Right, right. Well, it certainly looks like when we look around in our world at how many things seem to be breaking down systematically in all different walks of life, that we're kind of getting forced into asking ourselves, you know, some of these questions, like, how did it get this way? Where did this reality come from?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of exploration of that in your book.
Yeah.
And what I really dislike is how you cover sort of the full gamut of, you know, religious backgrounds and influences and all these different factors that have helped to help explain how humanity is kind of stuck in this current dilemma. I mean, you speak about sort of we're at this sort of point of breakthrough in our evolution. Yeah? We're kind of at the stuck point. We're stuck in this denial point.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's all these different, I mean, that's part of what I was doing in the book, was sort of collating all these different ways of looking at this present scenario and different philosophers, like the philosopher Gene Gebser, who wrote a book called The Ever-Present Origin, who looked at kind of the evolution of consciousness through these different kind of paradigms or structures that included, like, a whole way of conceiving kind of time, space, and consciousness. And he, you know, spent many years working on this magnum opus, The Ever-Present Origin, and ended up offering the hypothesis that we were on the cusp of a transition to a kind of new mutation of human consciousness and awareness, which would potentially be a different realization of time and space, and a kind of reintegration of the kind of magical and shamanic understanding of reality and the kind of, you know, understanding, cyclical understanding that earlier mythical civilizations held with our modern and rational, you know, technology and scientific worldview.
Right. And what were your personal experiences? I mean, as far as having those experiences in South America, you know, sitting with the tribes, going on experiences and expanding your perception of reality, and as far as how you were, how did that affect you personally as far as your perception and what you're bringing forth now?
It definitely, you know, over the course of years, I definitely felt like I was very transformed by a number of different experiences, and one of them was going to West Africa and having a tribal initiation with Bwiti in Gabon, taking Iboga, which is a psychedelic root bark that they use in their ceremonies, and then working with ayahuasca in the Amazon, and I visited the Mazatec Indians to a mushroom ceremony, then also kind of explored more like modern, you know, research chemicals and so on. You know, it had a number of effects. I mean, psychologically, I think I got cleared of a lot of baggage from my childhood and saw things in different perspectives, and, you know, had some experiences that sort of introduced me to these kind of subtler realms of visionary experience, and also had kind of various synchronistic and sort of confirmatory experiences that sort of bled over from the visionary realms to the real world, which really influenced and impacted my worldview. So, I mean, the first book, Breaking Open the Head, I kind of shift during the course of the book from secular materialism to kind of accepting this idea that there's a kind of psychic reality to existence, and that sort of consciousness is not separate. There's somehow a kind of intermeshed reality of consciousness and matter. And then, you know, realizing that was very much what these shamanic cultures were saying, I then tried to understand their perspective on the time that we're in now, and you know, what a lot of them seem to see as a time of prophetic transition or transformation.
Right, because we're now, not you and I, but we collectively, societally, the rest of the people, I mean, the world is stuck in this materialistic dilemma. Yeah, they've been driven by external influences, driven by fear, put into a position of sort of adherence to, you know, an outside world and disconnected from their inner selves. And now we're failing. we're failing as a planet. We're failing as a species. You write in the book that the current world situation is like a car whose driver responds to the fact that the gas is running out by flooring the accelerator. And when we look around at our world today, the things that are being professed by at least those at least currently in power are, you know, just absolute continual denial of our circumstances. So what have you seen as far as what are our circumstances right now? Where is the human race and how are we stuck?
Well, I mean, I think what you basically said was is pretty much accurate. And the book that I'm working on writing now is actually really thinking more on a systems level about how we could strategize and work our way towards like a more sustainable planetary culture. And I think there are a lot of very positive forces and indicators that suggest that that's you know becoming available to us. You know, I mean, I think part of the problem is, you know, America was kind of the driver for the planet, and you know, the American dream of kind of material consumption and unlimited affluence mm-hmm. has now spread like this virus around the globe. You know, but on the other hand, that American dream was propagated by, you know, media and propaganda. So I think there's a potential that a different type of paradigm could be sort of established through media and disseminated around the globe very quickly. So I guess that would be one of my hopes for how to overturn this thing. And I think a lot of the like necessary tools and techniques are actually available. It's just a question of the public knowing about them and then really demanding that they be immediately applied. You know?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I mean, I think we're getting enough signs that you know the culture is shifting, that people are waking up. I mean, this is what we talk about on our show every week. It's just the sort of the different areas where we're noticing pockets of perspective expanding and people stepping into their own choice a bit more. Whether it's you know companies that are bearing down on people and asking too much, that people are reaching an inner point of saying, "Well, wait a minute," that pushes a button in me that makes me realize that I'm being completely controlled, and now I'm going to rethink my role in the co-creation of what's evolving here. And plus, we're getting feedback. You write a lot of in the book about the validity of psychic phenomena. All these things that you know that so many of us have known about and thought about. You know, I was just thinking about you and you called. You know, that kind of stuff. We're getting more feedback about that. Science is giving us that data that is bringing it out of the realm of just blanket denial. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So how I guess. You were talking a little bit about the American dream and what our culture's like and what you're hoping that someday our culture is able to evolve into, and I'm guessing that's going to have something to do with the time around 2012. So how does that all work together?
Yeah, well, actually, the best way for me to deal with the whole 2012 thing has been to kind of forget about it and ignore it for the time being. Because in a way, it really doesn't, you know, matter. I mean, you know, we're obviously in this transformational period where, you know, if you look at all the statistics, within 30 years of present rates, like 25% of all species are going to be gone, and all mammalian species, and the oceans are 90% fished out of large fish. So within 20 or 30 years, huge chains of ocean life are going to disappear. So, you know, so we really have a 5 to 10 year window of opportunity to make this planetary shift in culture before things, you know, before, I mean, maybe humanity will exist if we don't do it, but maybe a fraction of the population will exist and we'll go through some tremendous winnowing of the population or series of cataclysms. So in a way, the healthier way for me to proceed for the time being was to kind of put the kind of mystical aspect aside and think more pragmatically. Mm. You know, although having said that, I definitely feel that like underlying that approach is the idea that there's a kind of underlying shift in paradigm that has to catch on from the kind of secular materialist belief system mm-hmm. to this deeper understanding that there is this kind of psychic reality and potentially, you know, the many other levels of development and exploration are possible for humanity, you know, that don't require 2,000-pound vehicles and so on.
Mm. Yeah. And you talk a bit about Burning Man in your book, and did you have an experience, Martin and I have been, and our experience of Burning Man is sort of that it's an example of the possibility of what people could create if they kind of started fresh with no rules and started over. And whether it's perfect or right or not, it was at least an opportunity that I don't normally get to have a completely different set of rules and see life from a different perspective. And I'm curious what your experience of that was.
Yeah, I mean, I've been there 8 times. I mean, I've written about it in both books and in numerous articles. I mean, definitely. I mean, I would say, like, you know, my internal joke to myself is, like, you know, because I've been reading all this political philosophy, that, like, the Paris Commune, I think in 1870, was, like, this huge event for Marx and Lenin, you know, where they saw that things could be different and what it would be like for workers to actually, you know, take over the state and stuff. So Burning Man has been sort of like my Paris Commune, you know. Like, I've seen that, you know, you could create a situation where people, you know, are interested in totally different types of exchanges than economic exchanges. There's actually not even a market economy at all. But having said that, you know, yeah, I mean, it's certainly not perfect. I mean, there's still, you know, a lot of kind of hipster delusion there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I love it, definitely.
But certainly it serves to, as you speak a lot about, is expanding what is possible, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
What's on the table of possibility.
Yeah.
And so one thing that blows my mind as far as just perceiving what's possible were crop circles. And you had the opportunity, Julie and I have been talking about this for a long time. We've been wanting to go and just experience this firsthand, the you know, the accounts and feelings of being within these spaces that are not fully explained really by anybody. What was your take on the crop circle phenomenon?
It took like 100 pages in the last book to really delve through it. But I think when you carefully explore the phenomenon and visit the circles and talk to all the different people who've been involved with it, I mean, including people who claim to make them all and stuff, it actually ultimately seems to be pretty clear that it really is probably not a human-made phenomenon in entirety. And there are a lot of different reasons, a lot of different types of proof that you can marshal to make that pretty evident. So, you know, I mean, from, like, biophysicists who studied what happens to the plants in the formations, and have published papers in peer-reviewed science journals that the plants could only have been affected by some kind of microwave or electromagnetic radiation coming from above, which kind of fits what people see when they see these balls of light over the field, to the incredible virtuosic geometries of the pattern, which are almost impossible to landscape out and do correctly, certainly in the course of a night. I mean, the ones that the hoaxers actually get paid by corporations to do in broad daylight, you know, with all the workers they want, all the time they want, are much shoddier and less precise and pristine than the ones that just appear with no authorship, you know. So, and then there are, I mean, it goes on and on. I mean, there's just a lot of stuff in the phenomenon that really, I think, indicates it's not a human-made phenomenon. So then you have to think about what it is. And I guess the thesis that I ended up putting forward in the book about the crop circles is that they are they could be conceived of as a teaching on the nature of reality and the nature of consciousness. And the question is, who is making the teaching or offering the teaching? I would say what you would have to ultimately consider it to be some other levels of galactic intelligence that really do seem to be working with human consciousness in a certain way. And I mean, it's kind of like if you look at the whole UFO phenomenon, which has developed over the last more than half century now, it's kind of a similar thing where it seems like there's a kind of education process going on where there'll be like waves of these sightings and then they'll vanish for a while, and then waves of abductions that'll kind of abate for a while. So it's almost as if these other powers in the universe are kind of introducing themselves to us in stages so that we have the capacity to kind of begin to intensify our own consciousnesses and awarenesses to allow for these possibilities to be legitimate.
And we've been seeing a lot of that through film, yeah, a lot of sort of attention kind of opening our minds up to how these kind of things may happen, how intelligence may come to the Earth. Often we're made to feel afraid of it, but I don't get any of that really from the book. I get also that you've been having, you've had personal experiences. I mean, you're with respect to Quetzalcoatl, yeah, and this energy coming through you. So let's speak a little bit about what Quetzalcoatl, the return of Quetzalcoatl, and what is that meaning to what is that meaning sort of process-wise? Because I want to avoid time. We're not talking about, we got 5 years to do this, but what's going on in our collective evolution right now as being brought through you?
Well, once again, I think there's some things that it would be like odd for me myself to like speculate on almost. I mean, you know, I'm just a little person here. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I had this experience while I was writing the book where I was, you know, kind of in these Santo Daime ceremonies in Brazil and sort of feeling kind of cynical about the whole thing. And at this point, at some point, a voice began to kind of speak to me or through me within my own head during an ayahuasca ceremony that explained that I was kind of some kind of avatar or intervention on the part of Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent of Mesoamerican myth, and that you know, Quetzalcoatl was this kind of principle of integration of you know, bird and snake representing, you know, heaven and earth or spirit and matter. And so that I was involved in this work of helping out this kind of process of integration of knowledge systems and the spiritual and the material knowledge system and so on. And yeah, I guess that's some of it.
This is great.
Also that you know, I mean, according to this voice that spoke through me, and, you know, it was a, I mean, I wrote about it in the book. It was a complicated process to sort of find how to situate this experience and how to deal with it. In some ways, it was almost like a humiliating kind of experience. But you know, this was this kind of prophesied time of the apocalypse, which is a time that, you know, which means uncovering or revealing. So it's kind of like a time when everything that's hidden is kind of put out on the table so that we can see what's been happening and then, you know, make a transformation to kind of a next threshold of human consciousness.
Right. I think I'm hitting on right now what's really resonated with me about the book is I've been developing sort of my own observation of the parallel between individual human development and collective consciousness development, or all of our society. And you do that in the book. You talk about your own process, and you just mentioned just now the stripping away, right? The humiliation of, you know, the pain of as we go through this learning process.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that's been denied or hidden comes to the surface, and we have to feel that pain in order to then break through to a broader perspective. We have to move past the judgment and the shame, all of which have been programmed upon us by outside factors. And you talk a lot about that. And then how so broadly societally we have so many areas of collective and massive denial where we're going to have to, I mean, we're going to be hitting the wall all over the place like really, really soon. Really soon. And you put forth that perhaps, you know, ripping off the pain, you know, having it be one major shock is what we're doing intentionally to thrust ourselves to the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you seeing? It's been a bit of a while since the book was finished. Is there anything else happening now in the past couple of years that's furthering your understanding of what's going on societally right now? Because we could be on the verge of a massive economic, you know, awakening. The crop circle phenomena, which is something that makes us think and perceive and open up our minds, has been completely blacked out in the U.S. So there's pieces of this reality of the collective world in our universe that a lot of us here in, you know, the States, a lot of people are just not even tuned into. And all of a sudden, stuff's going to start showing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I try to be a little cautious, I guess, because, you know, things never happen, you know, the way we expect or want them to. You know, there's always like a kind of sidestep in a different direction. I mean, actually, I was just in an email exchange with Carl-Johan Kallman, and I was asking him, you know, what he felt about, you know, 2008, which according to his predictions was the year of Tezcatlipoca, when everything was supposed to go into turmoil. And he was sort of like, well, actually, I thought it was going to be much worse by now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was almost like and I felt that in his work, that he'd kind of over-reified or concretized this process. You know, it's like, you know, sort of, I mean, not given to us to know, really. I mean, I think that the economic crisis is definitely a piece of it, and hopefully, you know, in a positive sense, that could potentially lead to an awakening around the subject of money, you know, which at the moment is just this kind of, since we went off the gold standard, it's just simply an abstraction. It's simply a, you know, a chit in the global casino. It's an accounting chit. And the whole monetary system is engineered to put huge amounts of this imaginary abstract stuff in the hands of already very, very wealthy business people and bankers, while those people on the ground who don't have those expensive educations and kind of obfuscatory knowledge of the financial system basically get fucked. You know, so, you know, I hopefully that'll become more and more apparent. I mean, if you look at what happened over the last months, you know, when all these people have been defaulting on their subprime mortgage loans that they didn't necessarily even understand because they were so complex and they were being given them, you know, and then the Federal Bank and the central banks of Europe simply hand, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars or billions of dollars, I think it is, back to the bankers. You know, that shows you that something is really, like, off-kilter here.
Right. This is from the book. I have proposed that this intensifying global crisis is the material expression of a psycho-spiritual process forcing our transition to a new and more intensified state of awareness. So certainly, you know, the more that these things happen, the more it thrusts us into awareness in the present moment.
Yeah, I mean, and it's very much like, I mean, I think, like, Stan Grof, work and, you know, Richard Tarnas's work, I mean, it's saying very similar things, that we're going through a kind of a initiatory shamanic kind of crisis on a species level, you know, so, and you know, as in the kind of a psychoanalytic process or a shamanic initiation process, ultimately the subject of the process has to come to realizations they can consciously mediate the archetypes and the forces that are being unleashed. So I think we're very much in that position right now.
So it's a tremendous opportunity.
Yeah, why not? Sure.
Well, why not? Cause some people could be freaked out, you know. Some people are, and as there's a discussion of that in the book, right, as far as like this point that we're reaching in expansion of our consciousness and our awareness, and those of us that are, you know, that are tuned in to doing our best to be conscious co-creators, and others that are getting stuck in the fear, and that it's just a natural process of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, I think that those people who are, whatever the first thing you said was, you know, consciously, whatever, getting better, like, we, you know, that group has to learn how to work together more intelligently, because, like, what's happened over the last decades is, you know, the kind of right wing has been able to create an authoritarian pyramidal structures of hierarchy, whereas the progressive group is kind of loosely affiliated and sort of in a way like individualized in its wanting to create its own little institutions, but not able to, you know, collaborate effectively. So somehow there has to be some kind of infrastructure for social transformation that will allow these groups to kind of work together strategically. I mean, because, you know, there's also realities like, I mean, Chris Heath wrote this book, American Fascists, about, you know, the tens of millions of believers in fundamentalism who are actively preparing for, you know, a fundamentalist takeover of the U.S. and a kind of fascism, fundamentalist kind of fascism. And that's a legitimate reality, you know. So, you know, those people who are, you know, into the consciousness movement, you know, we're going to have to somehow be responsible for subduing, you know, these kind of regressive movements and dangerous beasts that are going to become much more dangerous, you know, when you know, the resources become more scarce and the oil becomes more expensive, and there are a lot of very angry and frustrated people are going to be looking around for who to blame, potentially, you know. So hopefully that you know, that sort of ability for the you know, ones who want to promote sustainability and compassion and livability will also require a kind of, you know, fierce organizational infrastructure and kind of, you know, a dynamic process to move ahead.
Well, and also you speak about, if I may say, you know, psychic infrastructure, yeah? You speak a lot about the potential of the interconnectedness of our minds and what we can begin to just even begin to perceive as possible there with the harnessing of collective intention and focus, and how our inner thoughts are directing our outer reality. And then if we get a whole, I mean, if you hypothesize that, you know, aggregate number of human beings particularly focused and aligned in a particular direction can affect rapid change in what is reality.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. But I mean, that process is also, you know, it's not a rational process. It's kind of an intuitive. It's a process where it meets the meeting of intuition and rationality. So if you try to push it along from the rational side, I think it kind of malfunctions, you know, in a way. So,
right.
You know, so in a way, it has to be, it's like the Tao or something. It has to be, you know, the flow has to be observed and mastered. But if you try to, like, force it into, you know, dam it up or force it into certain channels, you'll end up, like, messing the whole thing up. You know, but I do think that there's a real learning process that is going on this kind of subliminal or intuitive level around psychic phenomena. And, you know, what I talked about in the book, I mean, other people have had the same concept, but, you know, if you look at, like, the history of electricity, you know, in the 18th century, you know, before the 18th century, people had seen lightning, but they hadn't, you know, understood that you could take electricity and make it into a transformative energy that could, you know, change the whole nature of the world. And then when we learned how to do that, in a century and a half, we changed the whole, you know, nature of the planet and created the whole industrial grids and everything like that. So it's potentially the case that psychic energy is another form of energy that might become available to sort of conscious human use. But just as that industrialized shift was a real major shift in consciousness, the you know, ability to reach that place where we can, you know, use psychic energy properly is going to be a massive shift or jump in consciousness. So once again, it's a little bit outside of what we can actually prepare for rationally, you know, although there are scientists, I mean, like the guys at Institute of Noetic Sciences and stuff, who are kind of working and trying to set up, you know, either statistical analysis or ways to research and collect evidence about this type of phenomena.
Right, right. Well, it kind of all brings it back to the self, that all any one of us can ever really be doing or focusing on is our own selves and our role in the collective. Yeah, mm-hmm. We really can't organize other people to be doing something per se, but we can begin to imagine what it might be like if we were co-participating with a whole bunch of other people that were precisely as aligned as we about really life, about everything, not just one little area of our lives where we have an affinity and some friendship, but really just everything about our being and the openness, the feeling of openness that comes with that. We could begin to imagine, I feel, you know, what becomes possible for incredible change.
Yeah, maybe. Hope so.
So, Julie, I know you wanted to ask a little bit more about what... I know we were trying to avoid the 2012, but it is the title of the book and the Mayans and this whole thing about the Mayan calendar and such.
I'm not trying to avoid it. It just hasn't been centered in my thought lately. Because in a way, it could almost like... my fear about the whole 2012 meme a little bit has been that it can become a cause for passivity rather than activation.
Mm.
If people feel that, oh, you know, this huge change is coming and, you know, we're going to go through the singularity, you know, vortex in 2012, you know, they may feel that they don't really have to contribute anything, you know, before then, or, you know, maybe it's enough just to... like every now and then to take some ayahuasca and hang out on the beach or something. So what I've really been trying to put forward as an alternative perspective is that actually, you know, what we do is, you know, everything that we do with our time and our energy affects our consciousness, so that we have this limited amount of time to engineer this transformation. So the more we learn how to focus our consciousness, we engineer our own transformation into this next level of you know, being or awareness. So I often use this quote from Nietzsche. It talks about how, you know, the deed creates the doer almost as an afterthought. You know, so I think it's like by getting, you know, 2012 becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, if we get our acts together and make a transformation by that point, you know, then we can have a great party.
Yeah, that's a good point. I often at the beginning thought of 2012 as ooh, the end of time, or, you know, some big scary thing that was going to happen and we were going to make it or not. But then the more a reading I did, it seemed to make sense that if that was the time that there was going to be a big, let's say, shift or switch, there's from where we are now to where we have to go is a long way, so we better start working now and transition over the course of many years. That'll be a lot easier, I think, and a better way to, actually probably more natural way to get there. So I've sort of seen it like you're describing, as we each have our own role to play, and all we do is, you know, focus on being the change and all of that, and eventually all of the pieces, you know, sort of come together.
Well, once you think of a number and you get fixated on a linear thing, and we can get into that in just a minute, Daniel, about how our dis full alignment with time affects our rhythms. But once we start thinking about a year of 2012, then we start getting into linear thinking, task, which pulls us away from really just being where we are in the present moment in
right.
process
then
of
it
whatever
brings
is
up
evolving.
All this fear. Which year is this? Yeah. Is this a dark year or a night or a day? And is this bad or is this good? And
right.
you know, it's like that doesn't do us any good. I've
right.
gotten stuck
for me,
there.
It started out as being curious. It's like, oh, gee, I wonder what they say is going on now. But then just also simultaneously knowing that my thinking that is affecting my perception of what's happening now, and I'd rather just be hanging out doing what I'm doing.
Yeah, well, I guess one way to think about the Mayan calendar, so I haven't really explored the traditional Mayan calendar as much as I should and would like to, but I mean, from my understanding of the basic principles, it's really about aligning with intention. Like your day sign gives you a kind of a window into understanding your kind of, you know, cosmic intention, like what you were setting out to do when you incarnated in this body, you know. So I think when you begin to align with your intention, you know, you just feel it. You know, it just kind of becomes like a magnetic attractor, and then the question of, you know, this date or that date doesn't really matter so much. I also had lunch with a rabbi, a Kabbalist, yesterday, and actually it turns out that this whole 2012. Kind of time frame fits in pretty well with the Jewish calendar and their sense of this being, you know, kind of approaching the end of time in a very positive sense in the Jewish calendar.
Hmm.
You know, it's a 6,000 year calendar. I think we're in like 5,700 something now. And so each 1,000 years is like a day of the week, you know, so we're now in the middle of the Sabbath, or I guess it's a Friday, and we're a little bit past noon, which is when the celebration actually starts. You know, apparently 1990 was like noon on the Friday, which was also when the serpent approached Eve in the Garden of Eden. I don't know, so he was just giving me this whole context for thinking about it from this Jewish background, which of course is also a tribal tradition, and it seemed to fit right in with all these other like puzzle pieces.
Wow.
Well, most of the all religions are all sort of saying something's going on now. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I don't really. Actually, I need to know more about what the hell Islam thinks about this particular time, or how they're considering it. I'm very curious, actually.
Right. It's just fascinating that when we think about this, for me, it's like, well, how the heck did I end up? I'm living in this time, and I seem to have always known in my life that I was going to experience a major, major change in the way that the world operates, and that I would also see our realization that we're not the only living beings, intelligent beings out there. And it just seems like we're kind of moving in that direction. And we always end the show with this notion of all change begins with you. And it's about the self. And you speak some of that in the book about freedom and what that is, and how Christ said that bringing forth what is within you. Yeah. But that doing that seems to also bring up incessant dilemma for people. You know, we have difficulty being ourselves. We have judgment. We have shame. We have all this stuff that holds us back. And if that really is the major inhibitor to us achieving personal freedom, I mean, stepping beyond all of our ego crap and really just being one with everything, how are we going to learn inside to stay aligned with that, to feel that, to go with that in the face of this increasing fear and BS and stuff?
I don't know.
How are you doing it?
I don't know if I have a good answer for that. I don't know. I mean,
Well, it sounds to me like from you're telling me you're doing the work. You know, you're doing what you feel is your message to convey and your work to do through your writing, through your website, through your other activities, aligning with your purpose in some way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. I mean, it would always be nice to. I mean, I have fantasies about not having to write anymore or whatever, but it seems to be what I'm good at. So, yeah, I've also been working on a video project, actually, if any of the listeners are interested. It's at postmoderntimes.com. We're doing a series of webisodes, interviews with different people that are going to be partially animated. And there's one with me, and then the next one is going to be with Kevin Danaher, Green Festival, then Rick Doblin from MAPS, multidisciplinary approach to psychedelic studies, and then a whole cast of characters. I feel like sometimes I've forfeited a little bit of self-development recently in order to push this sort of intellectual paradigm piece of it. But hopefully I'll be able to rebalance at a certain point.
So realitysandwich.com is your website, and folks can go there and learn more about you and tell us a little bit about Reality Sandwich, because that's, you know, consciousness bite by bite.
I'm very proud of this website. We started it, I guess, about 9 or 10 months ago now. And it's just been growing really well. Like, it's attracted. I mean, we've had like a zero budget so far. So we've gotten, a designer to help us out, and people have come in as editors, contributing writers, and a really wonderful web development company, Civic Actions, is working with us. And we're really seeing it as like the first stage in a number in a sort of interconnected series of web projects we want to do. That will hopefully, promote all these different ideas and visions and this kind of just the stuff that I've been writing about and thinking about. And I've been blown away by the quality of material that people have been giving us and people's dedication to the project and so on. We just had our first big event in New York City 2 weeks ago at the Chiva Mukti Yoga Studio. We probably had about 800 people there and had different artists and performers and workshops and so on. So it's feeling really, really good. Like, it really could become the kind of, international community hub for, a certain slice of the consciousness movement.
How did you come up with the name Reality Sandwich?
Yeah, I mean, well, the project I've been working on before that was called Evolver, and frankly, I would have preferred to reuse that name, but at the time I wasn't able to do it. So actually, I recently bought back that web name, Evolver.net, from my old company. And Ken Jordan and I both have a kind of beat connection. I mean, my mother was involved with Jack Kerouac in the 50s, and I was friends with Allen Ginsberg when I was young. And Ken's dad was the publisher at Evergreen Review and Grove Press. So I don't know. So we were just trying to come up with a name, and Reality Sandwich was the first one that really resonated with us. And we were very eager to get the thing up and running. So that's where it came from. I'm really thrilled with that. I mean, it just has tremendous vitality. We've been getting, great audience response and so on, a lot of comments. So it's fun.
Well, we hope it grows, and we look to, connect as much as we can.
Yeah, we have to synergize. It's only sensible.
Well, yes. I mean, what do you make of this interesting connection in the reality sandwich realm here?
I don't understand why you guys never got a realitysandwich.com for yourselves.
Well, because actually years ago I looked it up, and it was taken by somebody in New York about 6 years ago when I first looked it up, and it wasn't available.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I guess you have to look back periodically as things pop back up.
Yeah.
But Julie and I are actually coming to New York in a couple of months, so...
Oh, let's meet up when you're here.
If you're in town, perhaps we can connect.
I think I'm going to be out in San Francisco. That's where you are, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm going to be there for the Echo Cities conference in April.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Definitely. We'll look into that. But we definitely feel a similar thing happening. I mean, I've sensed that the, for lack of a deeper way to say it, the conscious people of the world, those who are realizing that something has to be done, that they need to be more cognizant of their own particular role and what's being co-created. They're learning these things too, like The Secret, and getting ideas and waking up slowly here and there. They're shopping at Whole Foods, they're doing yoga, and they're looking for hubs where they can connect with other people of similar belief and thinking. And this is something, another strong theme that you speak about, as far as now co-creating with communities of trust, the ways that we're going to know who to work with,
mm-hmm.
and how to connect with others,
mm-hmm.
and it just presents such a promising understanding of actually how we can just be ourselves and be involved in that oneness that gets evolved and creates.
Yeah, I hope it's not too much oneness.
Well, only oneness with those you want to be one with, right? If I don't want to be one with you, you wouldn't want to be one with me. We would not naturally end up meeting each other, so I can just trust that, and it's all going to be okay.
I think it's a very exciting time. I feel very privileged to be in this strange position of psychedelic folk philosopher that I seem to have found myself.
Well, it's pretty fascinating. Julie, when we meet with you more, we'll talk to you a bit about what Julie does, but she's bringing forth a lot of information that's very helpful to people and families in this whole autism epidemic in the U.S., and it's something that she's driven to, and I keep talking to people, you know, like yourself, who are really deeply passionate about, you know, what's inside them and communicating a message and being inspirational and sharing something really positive with humanity. And I just personally believe that the more that we allow ourselves to aspire to that kind of feeling, the more that each of us will become more comfortable to go inside of ourselves and to learn to slowly learn to overcome the fear and the anxiety, to choose more to go with what they feel with, to go with what's inside of them. Mm-hmm. And in 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, I'm left with just a really deep understanding of all the different phenomena that are taking place in my world today and how, through just my own introspection and my own connection with myself, that I can be even more than who I am.
How do you guys feel about the stuff about relationships and polyamory and monogamy and so on?
Oh, that's a good subject to talk about on the air for the very first time. we have lots of polyamorous friends and think that it's fascinating and wonderful and not necessarily something that personally we have done, but
something that we're absolutely accepting of. I mean, we understand the nature of it, and we have no judgments of. I think we seek to have no judgments of anything.
It seems to make sense in this new world where we're coming together, where we're, you know, whatever, making up our own rules, that love is a good thing, and why not have as much love as possible?
On my website, I articulate love as being the absolute absence of inhibition, a complete openness, a space where the creation of anything is possible. So when I think of it that way, when subjects come up, I notice, you know, where is the inhibition on behavior and being and flow, and does that putting that construct in place make sense to all parties involved? And that's where my exploration is. And often, you know, those constructs don't make sense, and people are inhibiting themselves from a relationship unnecessarily because of rules that don't apply to them. So it's basically saying we're into openness. What do you think?
I think it's still a work in progress from what I've seen of the polyamorous people and communities that I've observed. I think that monogamy is no longer functioning very well for a lot of people, but polyamory I can't say is functioning super well for most people that I've observed who are working with it either. I mean, there are obviously some exceptions, but I think that, you know, one thing that's interesting about it is that yeah, it requires like a lot of particularity, because then you have to really keep thinking about what your real desires are and doing the work to articulate them. Whereas monogamy and marriage, you kind of have this socially constructed norm, so in a way it's just easier to deal with that.
Yeah, it's more simple.
But that brings us right back to the kind of crux of everything, which is all changes within you to be sort of working with those phenomena, whether you're going to be in the game and take it all in, integrate it, deal with the pain, deal with the joy, and drive your own choice consciously, or if you're going to end up being at the whim of fear and just going with what is easier and not actually being a conscious co-creator. And that's the opportunity that's presenting itself to all of us today.
I also think, to answer the comment about that, you know, you're seeing a lot of monogamous relationships not working out and a lot of polyamorous relationships not working out. Well, I think on one hand, love is, you know, that takes a lot of growth and learning and experience for this whole love thing to really work out or create it where it works between multiple people. There's a lot of moving parts there. So I think it's just more of a function of that it's a wonderful, special thing, and it does take a lot of openness, and we're all learning, and it's not simple.
Well, that's the thing. We are learning, and the subject alone, it's not about, you know, a name of this or that. It's just a matter that we're opening our mind to the perception of things.
Do you guys ever think there might be too much opening?
Well, if I do that, then I start judging what's too much opening. You know, it's all just learning. You know, we're all just learning and figuring stuff out.
It's so funny because when I talk to people on the West Coast, there's like an almost opposite kind of cultural construct in certain respects than the East Coast. And, you know, I guess I sometimes experience it as a kind of, it's almost like an anthropological set of linguistic conventions about what's like the good and what's the not good.
Right.
So whenever I begin to feel that there's that kind of a thing, I always want to challenge the boundaries of it. But
I'll tell you what, we'll challenge when we get together. Dalen, it's been an absolute pleasure to connect with you today. I thank you for taking the time.
Awesome. Yeah, have a great day.
All right. What's the best way for people to get a hold of you again?
Daniel, realitysandwich.com, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. They can really get to know me because that's the book. And I don't know, they can email me through the website. Any email through Reality Sandwich will get to me.
Great.
Yeah. Thanks,
Thank
Daniel.
You.
Okay, cool.
Bye.
Bye.
All right. Well, we knew that would be a lively time. That was great. Which likes
well, just deep, incredible insight and hopefully palatable to everyone who's listening, because we do talk about what's going on in our world. We are blatantly honest. We are seeking truth. We are seeking to do our best as individuals in the conscious co-creation of everything that's in our lives, who we are as people, who we are with our friends and family and really everything, and doing our absolute best and being the change that we truly do want to see.
You have been listening to Reality Sandwich. All change begins with you. Listen to us every Thursday at noon. You can find this show and all past shows available at realitysandwichradio.com.
Thanks for listening.